Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is the Distraction Pieces Podcast, episode 247. And it is the first guest of the year. Drunkcast, obviously not included. And Films of the Year was me walking around on my own. Yes, I talked to an old lady who was walking her dog and confused as to why I was standing in the field talking to myself. But that doesn't count as a guest. But Eddie Bloody Marston counts as a guest. I was delighted to get the chance to talk to Eddie. We've got a lot of mutual friends. I've been a fan of his work for a long time. But I was recording two on this day. The other one comes out in a couple of weeks, so maybe I shouldn't mention who it is because it's not out for a bit. But I was a bit nervous because they were both people I've not met. Both people I'm fans of their films, but I don't really know how they are as people or if we're going to hit it off. And spoiler alert, both went really well. But this one was the first one of the day. And I couldn't have been more pleased because I think when I'm a bit nervous and intimidated, because Eddie's a great actor and I'm kind of only starting off in that world, I'm a few years in. So I think when I'm a bit intimidated, I proper over-prepare. And honestly, I came out of this one feeling like it had been some inside the actor's studio shit. I felt I was really pleased with how it went. I was his first interview of a long day of press for Mowgli, which is on Netflix. So yeah, I was his first interview in that. And you never know how it'll be early in the morning. But again, absolutely hit it off. Since then, I've watched him in Vice, which comes out soon. I was invited to a preview because I may be having someone involved in that film on the podcast. And Eddie pops up in that. And he's just amazing. I mean, I'll stop rambling in a minute because we really cover a lot of his career in this relatively short amount of time. And his insights into his methods and his approach are fantastic. Again, you got to realise this is all good for you guys as listeners. And I love that Distraction Pieces podcast has now broken 13 million downloads. It's one of the biggest podcasts in the UK. But even if no one else was listening, the amount I get from these interviews to educate myself and to help myself going forward is flipping fantastic. So yeah, Eddie's great. We'll get into that. Before we do, I will once again mention that we are brought to you as ever by SpeechDevelopmentRecords.com. It's the new year. This is traditionally the time that merch sales and everything drop out of their own arse, and it's terrible. No one wants to buy. So if you're a fan of the podcast, you're welcome to go over there and buy some podcast merch. I'm about to launch, I know I've been mentioning it for ages now, some new merch. I've shot a video of it. It's the best merch announcement video I've ever done. It looks amazing. I don't think we're ready to put them on sale yet as this goes out, but it will be in the next week or so, I promise you. So, yeah, keep an eye on SpeechDevelopmentRecords.com. Also, before we get into the podcast, I'll mention Patreon.com. Everyone over in the Patreon group, it's only $1 a month. Everyone over in the Patreon group knew about Eddie and know who the other guest I interviewed that day is because I post a selfie with the guest after I record it each time I go on there. And at the end of this month, in the last 2 weeks of this month, I've got, I think, 4 or 5 guests I'm recording, and there's a small chance there's an absolutely insane one that's going to be added, which, yeah, if that happens, you want to be a member of the Patreon group, because you, honestly, everyone you think of now in who this guest is going to be, you're wrong. It's not even going to be someone it would cross your mind would be on this podcast. So if that one happens, then yeah, that's going to be exciting. Oh, I'm getting all excited thinking about it. It might not happen, so I'm not going to say much more. But on the Patreon as well, I now do, starting in Feb, which is just around the corner, I do Poem of the Month on the first Monday of the month, where I've been going through old hard drives and finding all old spoken word pieces and performing them, reading them for the first time in 5-10 years and performing them for the first time as well. So I've been recording that. They're the first of the month. And then I've been recording Distraction Pieces Rewinds, which are the third Monday. So the Poems are the first Monday of the month. The Rewind is the third Monday of the month. And that is me going over old episodes, and I've recorded 3 or 4, and they've been, I expected them to be 10, 15, maybe 12, 20 minutes. Each one is 35, 40, 45, 50 minutes, because it's been really good fun to remember the recording of some of these episodes, how they came about. I talk about how I first met a Russell Brand and how it kind of offended Paloma Faith, because Russell's the first guest. I talk about the fear after recording my first ever Distraction Pieces podcast and having the worst drive of my life afterwards. So yeah, there's a lot of good stuff to come there. That's all over on Patreon. It's $1 a month. As some of you will remember, I started the Patreon. I wasn't going to be doing anything on there. The reason I had it as $1 a month rather than all these tiers of 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 or whatever. The reason I didn't have any of that was my plan was not to use it. Just to say, look, I have people ask all the time if they can donate or contribute. If you don't want to buy merch, here's somewhere you can just sling $1 a month. It's less than, that's basically buying me a couple of pints a year. If you listen to this podcast and think, oh, I really enjoy this, if I ever bumped into Pip in a pub, I'd buy him a beer. If you think that's the case, then just subscribe on the Patreon, because it's probably 2 pints a year, because the dollar comes in at like 70p. So, no, maybe a full round, a full evening. No, it's still only like 12 quid, if that, under 12 quid. Anyway, I've gone off on a tangent. That, yeah, I was going to not post anything on there, but then I really enjoy it as a little community. I talk about it on there a lot. It's kind of nice because it's closed and you don't have all the other dickheads who are on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram. So we have our little community and we chat and all that. So yeah, anyway, I decided to add all this new stuff, but I also decided to keep it at $1. You can pay more over there if you want, but I wanted it to be nice and affordable. And again, the reason I chose $1 is, and I say this on there a lot, I want it to be an amount that you don't notice coming out of your account each month. I want you to just sign up and then be able to forget about it. Because if you dropped £1 a month, it wouldn't hit you too hard, hopefully. Or if it would, then don't join the Patreon. That's the kind of the idea. Equally, I kind of say on there, if you wouldn't notice £2 going a month, then up it to £2, you know what I mean? But yeah, that's all I'm going to say. God, I've rambled on longer about Patreon than I intended. Let's get on with this podcast. As said, absolutely humbled to get to sit down and learn from someone who I think is one of the true greats in British acting. In acting in general, I'm telling you, Vice is a masterclass of performances, and Eddie was one of the people chosen to be part of that masterclass. So, yeah, and Mowgli, we talk about that a load, so we'll get into that now. Here it is, episode 247 of the Distraction Pieces podcast. So, yeah, I'll begin. I'm joined today by Eddie Marston. How are you, sir?
I'm very well. How are you?
I'm good. I'm good. How do you find these kind of press runs? Because you're someone that keeps so busy. Like, there's a lot I want to talk to you about across your career, because I'm a fan of a lot of the projects you've done. But it must be tough when you keep so busy acting-wise that then you have to be kind of pulled back to talk about something that was maybe two gigs ago.
This was, I mean, Mowgli was first, we started Mowgli in 2013, I think. I think it was 2013, I think.
That's amazing, because when I was working on, I did a show called Taboo a couple of years ago, and Louis Circus was on that, and he had to cut to go and work on Mowgli. Yeah. So it was one of them. I was like, this has been a long time coming, Well, you, so how is that to kind of to revisit it?
It's fine, actually, because when you work on a project, in order to do it well, you have to work out what your function is within the piece.
Yeah,
you have to look at the whole script and work out what it's trying to say and what your function is within that, and so you learn to dissect it and to analyze it to such an extent that you can describe it succinctly to yourself in order to do it. So therefore you come back to that when you discuss it.
That's fantastic. Yeah. And again, it must be nice because you're kind of at times, particularly if it's been this long a period, because with animation, there's right. even longer than with with most things. It must be kind of nice because you're coming back fresh as such, and there's going to be a lot that you weren't part of.
No, and I didn't see it. And yeah. So you see what they've done with it. But there's a lot of movies like that.
Yeah.
There's a lot of movies, especially with these big superhero movies and CGI, like the Deadpool and stuff. You'd see what you did, and then you see how it fits in context with everything else.
Yeah, it's amazing because that seems to be going across the board.
It does.
There was when, and not to keep going back to a Taboo, when I was doing this series, a Taboo, I started to get kind of sent previews of the new rushes and things like that, and I kind of asked if they'd stop sending them because there was so much being added and so much done that was amazing. I wanted to just see the finished thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Because I'm new to the acting side of things, I was like, it's nice to be part of that journey, but part of it as well, it must be nice to go, I've done my bit. Now, there you go.
It is.
And then you get to come back and go, oh, wow, this isn't how I could have possibly imagined
it. Well, it is, but then again, if you have a healthy mindset, and bear in mind, my wife's a makeup artist, so I am married to the crew. In a sense, you do realise that it is both an interpretive and a collaborative art form.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
You're not completely.
You're not painting something on your own. It's not something that you create on your own. So you do realise that it is enhanced by other talents and you do kind of just pass the ball along.
Yeah. It's one of the most exciting things about it as an industry is, exciting and scary things, I think, is the lack of control. You can go and do your thing, but then almost it takes off some pressure in a way, because there is that kind of, well, I've done, as you said, my role and my part in this puzzle to the best of my ability. Now it could go either way. It's kind of out of your hands.
Yeah, you've got no control over it. That happens, especially the kind of parts that I play as well.
Yes.
As being a kind of character actor, so a lot of them are cameo roles. So you don't know how much is going to be in or out because it depends on the arc of the movie.
Yeah.
I mean, I always think that movies are like roller coaster rides or ghost train rides that the audience sit on and you take them through.
Yeah.
And I invariably play the guy who goes boo.
So
therefore you are subject to when someone's editing something based on the arc of the story, you are subject to whether you could be cut or not.
Yeah. Mm. The first role I ever got, I was so excited. It was a Guy Ritchie film. I spent a month. I shot a lot of stuff. And when it came out, I literally had the whole story arc I was part of had been cut out. So it was that experience. But because of that, is it important to you to choose your roles and your gigs based on the content and the experience that you're going to get, rather than how's this going to translate? What does it this turn into? Because as you said, if there's always the risk of your only experience of that film being the actual experience of filming it because of your editing out or whatever else. So, and also with family life.
That's a big...
Married into the industry as well, there's got to be an understanding there. But still, if you're taking yourself away from your wife and kids, then it's got to be for the right thing, right? Rather than maybe in the early days when it's like, I just want to get as much work as possible.
Yeah, there is the considerations on how you balance your family life with your work. So therefore, when I do Ray Donovan, I commute back and forth. But when I finish Ray Donovan, I try as much as possible to do something at least in Europe.
Right.
Though it's getting harder now. Most of it is being in the US, so it's getting harder to do it within Europe. I always try to choose something that's completely different to the thing I just did.
Right.
That's the way I kind of maintain an element of control over my career because I'm loath to be pigeonholed. I hate to be defined by people.
Yeah.
Defined by anything, by my colour, by my race, by anything.
Yeah.
So I always try to do something that defies their preconceived ideas of me.
Yeah.
Because then that guarantees longevity. And it doesn't give them the control over my career. It gives me control over my career.
Yeah. It's beautiful, though, because that has to take some resolve, I guess, because it really feels like it's a long game.
It is a long game.
In that approach, it's saying, I'm going to have... Because, again, if you're kind of... To pick someone out of a hat, but a Tom Cruise character,
he
plays a Tom Cruise character.
He does, all
and
the
that's
time.
It. And that has meant that grows and grows. Whereas if you're having that variation, it's that slower burn. But, like, when I had the opportunity for this chat, I knew there was a lot of stuff I liked of yours. And when I was going on IMDb, I was like, oh, there's loads more as well. Yeah, there was that as well. And it's that kind of, even as someone who is already a fan of you, there's a lot that, because there's such a variation, you forget that that's Eddie in that. So
And also it means that people don't join up the dots as much.
Yeah.
So the momentum is not as, how can I say, it's not as instantaneous as it would be if I was, if you were marketing Eddie as, me as to be always be me, or to be a kind of Tom Cruise character, and to always be the same character. The marketing of that is very easy because you know this is what you do and you do it.
Yeah.
You know, someone like me, it's harder to join the dots because there's such a variation in what you do. So to create a narrative that you can sell or market, in many ways is much harder. But I think it's being overcome now just because of the persistence of just keep working.
Yeah.
And then people suddenly go, oh no, this bloke does all this stuff. And also it's just, I think that that's what an actor is.
Yeah.
I always wanted to be an actor. I didn't want to be a, movie star.
Yeah.
I mean, I'd love to be a big movie star. But what I mean is it wasn't my goal.
Yeah.
My goal was to be good at my job. And I looked at what an actor should do, and what an actor should do is create different characters. So you create different characters.
It's such a strange balance or conflict these days, because it seems to be either you're chasing fame for fame's sake, or you're chasing art for the sake of art.
Yeah.
And those two can cross over. I was brought up to kind of, I'm not against the idea of fame and exposure, but for something I'm good at.
Yeah.
Not just kind of to be on TV or to be on the
set. Exactly.
Like, if I'm good at something, I'll take as much praise as the next man. That's a beautiful thing. But I don't just want to be, oh, we can put you on this show or on this show. It's like, well, no, that's not. That's exposure, not
because also if they're putting you on that show, they can take you off that show.
Yeah.
And they can, if you've built a career based on learning a craft, that can never be taken away from you.
Exactly.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know how to do it.
Yeah.
So I've always felt, I've never wanted somebody to bestow something on me that they can take away.
Yeah.
I've always wanted to be able to obtain it myself.
And if you hold that control and that focus, then it is something that you genuinely. There's a great documentary on an artist called Hokusai, who's
the guy who painted the
he did the wave.
And I went to see an exhibition of his about 15 years ago.
It's absolutely amazing. But he kind of came into prominence really late in his life, and he wrote himself off late in his life. It was like about. I think it was about 60, he'd got a lot of fame and he decided that everything he'd done was rubbish.
Yeah.
And his aim was that by 70, he'll be good. By 80, he'll be a master.
Yeah.
By 90, he'll be every brushstroke will be a work of art. Yeah. And he died at, I think, 85. So he died on his way there. But it's something that really, after I saw that, it motivated. I felt it translated well into acting, in that it is something that you should, in theory, always be improving upon. It should be an old man's game. And you can argue against that on box office or Hollywood appeal or whatever else, but purely from the craft, it's something that you should always be improving upon and learning from the last role you got and the last experience and getting better and better along the way.
Well, if you work out what you consider to be the obstacles to being good at as an actor, the main obstacle to being good at an actor is egotism, is thinking that it's about you. It's being in front of a camera or on a stage and wanting approval from the audience. That's the worst thing an actor can do, is want approval from the audience. And as you get older and you your life develops, you have relationships, you have children, you have friends, you less and less look for approval from other people. And the less approval you look for other people, the freer you become as an actor, and the more in the moment you can be. And that's, so you do get, as you get older as an actor, you do improve with age. The normal arc of most human beings, as they get older, they become less egotistical, they become less worried of self-conscious and less worried about what people think. So you become even more free. And when you become free, you become a better actor.
Did you find parenthood fast tracks that? Because that's the ultimate removal of ego.
Completely. One of the things, because of exhaustion. You turn up and you're exhausted. And when you're exhausted, you can't. One of the first things you let go of is self-consciousness. You know, that idea that I want to be admired, or I want to be desired, or I want to be praised. You give that up because you want to get on. When I turn up now, I want to get in, do my job, be good enough to do my job well enough so that someone will employ me in the next job, and then get home to my family. So I'm actually very, very the reason I think I get employed a lot is because I'm a very efficient actor.
Yeah.
You get me in and I'll do a good job and I'll go.
Yeah.
You'll make your day and I'll get a plane home and that's it.
Yeah. It's great. It sings to the kind of, I hate that it's become a thing or an accepted thing that the goal is to steal the show. That shouldn't be the goal. That's not an actor's role. That's not an artist's role, which is to enhance the show.
It is.
To make the show this greater thing. But the idea that you're meant to go in there and steal the show or steal the scene, it's like, no. You've got the wrong outlook if that's what you're going to do, in my opinion. Career-wise, it might be good because it might mean that you're that guy that pops on screen or...
Yeah, but I think you can still do a good job
and
enhance the show. It's a bit like being a session musician. There's a famous session band called The Wrecking Crew who played... backed people all through the 60s and they were all amazing at their jobs but then they were always employed but they were never I think they were never the ones under, you know, they were at the front of the stage. So in a sense it's like being a really good, for me it's like being a really good session musician. I turn up and I do the job and I do it really well. Lovely. And people always call me in and ask me to do the next one. And if you do it well, then you can have a magic moment, but it doesn't detract from the overall story.
Completely. It's not a false thing. It's not a here's my moment. That magic moment might be given to you by one of the other actors if you're all on the right page.
Yeah.
If you're all trying to just enhance things, they might see that this is the bit for this person to shine. If I step back slightly, it enhances it for everyone.
I mean, when I work with Mike Lee, one of the great dilemmas of being an actor is... this battle within yourself, should I be clever or should I be truthful?
Yeah.
That's one of the big battles, And when you work with Mike Lee, you realise the only answer is to be truthful. You can't be clever.
Yeah.
You know, because being clever is dishonest in a sense. Yeah.
And it's freeing if you can take route. Because it takes pressure off. I remember earlier in the year I had an audition for a Shea Meadows thing and I had to literally... open the email with the description and film it immediately and send it back immediately. So there was no time to prep or to be clever or to think about it. It was just, and I had to record my first ever try it, all this kind of thing, all these pressures. And I adored that because I was like, right, there's no overthinking.
No,
it's literally, here's what it is. Here's me doing the thing that you've asked me to do. Yeah. Not here's the concept I've come up with is this or that. It's like, no, here it is. Here's me doing it.
Yeah, yeah. And in a sense, what you're doing is you're forgiving yourself.
Yeah.
You're forgiving yourself. You're going in and thinking, I'm going to just do the best I can do. I can't do any more.
Yeah.
I forgive myself. I'm going to do it. And there's a lot of actors, especially young actors, who don't forgive themselves.
Yeah.
They try too hard because they're too hard on themselves.
Yeah.
As I've got older, I've realized that I relax a lot more now.
Yeah.
And I don't punish myself.
It's perfect. Yeah. It's perfect. So was acting always your target or on your list? Because you grew up in London. Right. And it's... a working class families at that time, you're not getting told that by a careers advisor.
No. I mean,
it's not seen as a viable thing.
No,
at that
it wasn't.
Point.
I think when I was about 11, I think I had dreams of being an actor, but there was no means by which I could pursue it.
Yeah.
And I think it went on the back burner for many years. And then I left school at 15 and I had no qualifications. And then I got a job as an apprentice printer and I was studying my apprenticeship. And then, My mates and I used to dance a lot in clubs in the East End and warehouse parties and stuff. And somebody saw me and my mates dance in a party and they said, could you come and be extras in this film? And we went on this film and became extras. And suddenly I saw someone do a scene. It was Jamie Foreman, who's now a friend of mine.
Yeah.
And he did a scene and it was fantastic in a scene. And I remember thinking, I can do that.
Yeah.
And that it triggered it.
It's amazing, right?
It
must have been so... powerful at that time to get that exposure to what the reality is, because again it's such a strange balance because it is hard, it is an art form, it takes skill, but to watch from the first time from the outside you can go, oh, it's attainable though. It's not something that's easy or I can walk into, but it's attainable.
It was obtainable, and I was looking at what he was doing and I instinctively kind of understood what he was doing.
Yeah.
And I think when I think back now on what acting has given me, over the last 27 years of being an actor and what it's given me much more an expanse in language and articulacy, which what I realised coming from Bethnal Green was that I had a limit a limited approach to language,
yeah,
and to articulacy. And I realized that if you can define a thought through language,
yeah,
then you're no longer subjected to that thought.
Yeah,
you can define it, and you can't be something and define it at the same time. So for that brief millisecond, you have autonomy over that thought process.
Yeah.
So therefore, you can take control of your life.
Yeah.
And language gave me that.
That's amazing.
You know, I suddenly realized, if I look back, I don't know whether what I've got out of acting is what acting offers anyone, or what I've got out of acting was what I was always looking for.
Mm.
But what it's given me is a sense of autonomy and a sense of to transcend my own limitations,
yeah,
that I myself perceive limitations.
Yeah.
I define myself in a certain way, and acting has enabled me to transcend that.
Yeah,
you know, through having to study concepts and ideas and philosophies that embody films and the themes of films, in order for me to work out what my function is within that. And it's also because of the language. Language has freed me up,
yeah,
much more than I ever thought it would.
It's beautiful. And, mm, and do you feel you've learned from the characters that you've had to embody? Because, again, I think it's such an underrated thing in how much we can learn from characters in film and TV. Jimmy Stewart as Elwood P. Dowd in Harvey taught me that the traditional drives and ambitions aren't the be-all and end-all. John Cusack in Say Anything,
yeah,
taught me the kind of how hard is it to be in a good to just decide to be in a good mood and be in a good mood.
Yeah,
the autonomy over your own feelings.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's so much that I've learned from watching characters, and it strikes me that you've played such a variation. There must be a lot that you do your job in finding that character, but then when,
yeah,
you step away from it, you can kind of go, I know I created that, but I've learned something from person I created.
Well, the funny thing is, you don't really create the character. You serve the character.
Yeah.
The character's created by the writers.
Yeah.
And in a sense, if you think, where did the writers get that character from? They got it from the collective consciousness. Do you,
yeah,
understand? It,
yeah,
arises.
Yeah, yeah,
so all,
yeah,
you're doing really is serving the kind of collective consciousness.
Yeah.
When I play evil characters, which I do quite a lot, I try not to make them two-dimensionally evil. I try to find a reason for why they do things, and,
yeah,
that makes them even more frightening. I once played a guy who created the Paralympics, and that was a,
yeah,
fascinating character to play.
Wow, of course.
Because this man, it was a guy called Ludwig Gutmann, and his daughter called him Hitler's gift to the world, because Hitler was exterminating disabled people. And Gutmann, and as a Jew, fled to Britain, and they gave him this hospital to look after. And he looked after the hospital, and they thought that the spinal injury patients would live for 6 months. And he transformed it,
wow,
and created the Paralympics and changed their lives. So if Hitler hadn't done what he had done, you wouldn't have got Ludwig Gutmann.
Yeah.
So in a sense, you kind of realize that out of everything, there is something. His daughter literally said he was Hitler's gift to the world.
Yeah, it's amazing. And,
yeah,
again, I think one of the things I've always got from when you're playing evil characters is that simple realization that, and which is often, I think, overlooked in characters in films and TV, is that bad guys don't know they're the bad
guys.
They don't
guys,
don't think
bad
of themselves, or
no,
in general, they don't think of themselves as bad guys. So it can become a little one-dimensional if you have this character that's,
yeah,
this evil.
Yeah.
Whereas if you kind of bring an empathy and a human side to them, that I think I'm doing what's best.
Yeah,
in my
exactly
mind, I'm doing
exactly
what's best.
I mean,
whether that be for the world, for my family, for me.
Yeah,
there's,
yeah,
something
we there. There's no evil people. There's just unhappy people in search of happiness.
Yeah,
that's all it is.
Yeah, yeah.
And if you find out what it is, I mean, when I played Himmler, the fascinating thing about Himmler is that he thought towards the end of the war that he was the one who could negotiate with the Allies because he was a nice one.
Yeah.
So he never realized, he never saw himself in the way we see people.
Is there any, is it tough having to try and find the good in characters like that, in real life characters, trying to find that empathy with someone who is such a historically evil character?
No, it's the nugget. If,
yeah,
you can find that, it's where the money is.
Mm.
Go for that, first of all. Find that. And then allow that to justify everything you do. And then allow the audience to make a judgment on the action.
Yeah.
But don't you comment on the actions while you're doing them.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
find,
yeah,
the nugget. Find, okay, the reason why they're doing it. And it makes it even more terrifying for the audience, because partly the audience can sense on a subconscious level, they can understand why he's doing it, because it exists in all of us.
Yeah.
We've all done evil things and felt justified in doing them.
Yeah.
So if you can find that and play it, it makes the audience more uncomfortable.
Yeah, completely. Mm. And it's a beautiful thing. It's something that excites me going forward into acting and stuff like that, is that I genuinely believe that all humans are capable of great beauty and great ugliness.
Yeah. They're
both there. It's, you know, I'll watch horrible things happening on the news and I'll be disgusted, but then there'll also be part of me like, I can see that happening. I can't just paint them just as this unimaginable monster. I can see the reality there.
Yeah,
and that's an exciting thing to try and explore.
There was a Roman playwright who said, nothing human is alien to me.
Yeah.
And that's the core of it, really.
It's perfect. Yeah. So how did you take those steps from being a dancing extra in the background of a thing to the and again, it's been so amazing doing so many of these podcasts and interviews and seeing. And it makes me sad because it's almost something that's died, but almost every actor who's worth their salt and has been doing it for a while has done either The Bill, Casualty, you know, all these
I did Crime Monthly. I was in every Crime Monthly. I did every crime in London and I always got caught.
Yeah. Amazing. So how was it to kind of have that? It feels like those kind of shows are almost the workshop or the school or the apprenticeship or were at that point.
They were.
So how was that to kind of get your foot in the door and learn on the job?
Brilliant. And also to do fringe shows, to do plays above pubs in every pub in London. And,
fantastic.
And to make mistakes and there only be three people in the audience. It's the best way to make a mistake, rather than make a mistake in front of millions of people, you know. To learn your trade in anonymity is a great gift.
I was discussing this with a friend of mine who I was on the spoken word scene with, and I had 10 years of doing music and spoken word and touring the world, and I've stopped now to focus on acting, and a few people have asked me to do just one more show or whatever, and I was saying to a friend of mine in the pub, just saying, the fact is, I was good then. I've not practiced in a long time now. The time I was bad, exactly as you say, I was in rooms of 4 or 5 people.
Yeah.
Now if I come back, I'll have that big crowd and I won't have time to get good again. I'll have those potential periods of being shit and then kind of, there's loads of people who are expecting
goodness.
So that is a beautiful thing to have that.
Yeah.
That at time, the time to you be don't realize. Rubbish. The time to be conceited and to be pretentious, all these things. But no one's there to see it.
No, and it's also really about how you've got to get rid of yourself. You know, because it's all about you when you first do it.
Yeah.
And so when you get rid of all that,
and
then suddenly you do realize it's not about you, that's when you become good at it.
Yeah.
When you get yourself out, your ego out of the way, really.
Yeah.
But I think one of the things that got me through acting early on was I was never very successful in the East End.
Right.
I was never, if you look at actors like Ray Winston or Danny Dyer, these guys, they are very successful in that world. You can imagine in the pub, everybody wants to befriend Danny Dyer or Ray Winston, and they're tough guys or whatever they are. I don't know Danny Dyer. I know Ray Winston very well.
Yeah.
Very beautiful, gentle man, but he knows how to be in that world.
Yeah.
And in many ways, I didn't know how to be in that world. There was a lot of chaos when I was a kid, and there was a lot of chaos on the estate where I was a kid. There was a lot of breakdown of marriages and stuff. But a friend of mine recently said that when you saw someone's dad, you called the police because there were court orders and stuff.
Right, yeah.
So there was a kind of family breakdown on the estate. So there was chaos.
Yeah.
And I think that created a vulnerability in me and a need to understand, a need to find the answer. And I've always had this incredible need to understand things. And that's why early on I became a born-again Christian for a period of time, and then I gave that up. And then I got and acting got me interested in an element of Buddhism and Buddhist philosophy. And just a need to understand, because I always realized, I grew up white working class, but most of my friends were black.
Yeah.
And I actually took refuge in, there was a black family, a St. Lucian family, who I'm very close to now. And I actually spent more time in their house than I did in mine.
Wow.
So the first orthodoxy I ever rejected was the white working class racism. rejected that at the age of about 8 or 9. I just thought, this doesn't make sense. What you're saying doesn't make sense, because I spend a lot of time with these people and they're not the way you describe them.
Yeah.
So when, and when you're at a young age, you learn to reject one orthodoxy, but you haven't had the time to establish your own narrative or your own belief system.
Of course.
You're always looking for something.
Yeah.
And I think that...
So you know what you don't follow. But you're not ready to say, but here's what the answer is.
Exactly. Like,
I know that's not the answer.
Yeah, I know.
So what is the answer?
I don't know.
But I know that it's not that. So let's leave that for
And that's perfect for acting.
Yeah.
That's perfect for acting.
Yeah, of course.
Because then you start to read scripts and look at characters and try to find the paradox in every character and you'd look under the skin of every character and try to find, don't look at the obvious, don't go for the simplicity.
Yeah.
And acting's taught me to have a healthy cynicism against any form of simplicity.
Yeah.
Political, all this kind of populism you see now, to the right and to the left. I agree, a healthy cynicism with it all, because I think it's not.
Yeah.
It's not true. The world doesn't work like that, you know. So I think that was one of the reasons why it took so long for me in many ways to get going.
Mm-hmm.
But once I did get going, I could do many different things, because it was about trying to understand. I've always tried to understand.
Yeah.
You know, Lao Tzu said that ignorance is a human condition. And once you accept that and then you ask questions, it's the best way to be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, completely. I mean, I said that there's a lot I want to get through and we won't get through it all, but part of that is because the first time that you came to my attention was very early on. I was a big fan of the series Game On.
Yes.
And you were in that as Stoat as...
Yeah.
And I've purposely not kind of re-researched it, because I want to see how much is kind of clear in my memory. And my memory of it was that you were kind of an ex of Mandy's and you were just out of prison.
Escaped from prison
and on the run. So how was it to kind of go, because that was a weird show at the time. It was so popular, and then it seemed to just absolutely disappear.
Yeah.
But it was this very hot and kind of cutting edge feeling. A lot of it now, I'm sure you'd go back and go, oh, they were cutting some of the wrong edges there, but maybe put that edge back. But it was that, it did feel hot and exciting and new. So how was that to be part of? And it was, you know, a comedy as well, so.
Well, I was just starting to work then. I think I was just beginning to earn a living as an actor.
Right.
So it was, I think I was doing a play at the National then for the first time. I'd just done a play at the Bush and I did a play at the National. So I'd been doing fringe plays in London for about 8 years and I hadn't earned a living. And then suddenly I started to get paid to do things. But I studied 3 nights a week with a really fantastic drama teacher. So it was at that point where I had learned, made mistakes and learned how to do it in anonymity. And then suddenly they put the spotlight on me and, can you be Stoat in Game On, or can you do the... I did Pinter's The Homecoming at the National.
Wow.
And suddenly people thought, oh, where did this bloke come from? Well, I've been doing it. I was rubbish 8 years ago.
Yeah.
And I'd learned to act in anonymity. So by the time they asked me to do Stoat, I kind of knew what I was doing.
Yeah.
You know, I was the guitarist who was playing, practicing in his bedroom for 8 years before he walked into a studio.
It's similar. I had Stephen Graham on here, who I've worked with on Taboo, and I'm a really close friend of mine, and he was saying how he had a similar thing with when he was in the Shane Meadows
films. He did.
So many of them were kind of cast from the street.
Yeah.
But he'd been doing theatre.
He'd been doing
all this stuff. So in a way, it was kind of annoying for him, because it was kind of, oh, you've been plucked out. And I was like,
yeah,
no, I've been working at this 10 years already.
Yeah, I'm kind of, he's a good friend of mine, very close friend of mine, Steve. But that similarity where people suddenly think they think.
Particularly if you're doing a good job, it feels so
authentic,
natural.
It's so authentic.
Acting. Yeah, you've just grabbed them.
And they don't realise that actually he's a lot more of a craftsman than they give him credit for.
Yeah, I love that. So how was it then to go on to things like Gangs of New York with
Stacey
and with Stephen and with Leo and Daniel Day-Lewis and all these people? Kind of, how was that?
My first day in Gangs of New York, they said, you're going to have lunch with Jim Broadbent, because my character was Jim Broadbent's sidekick.
Yeah.
And I went and had lunch with Jim Broadbent, and I had lunch every day with him for 9 months.
Amazing.
So it was a great education for me to be with him, because one thing you don't realise about Jim is he's not only a great actor, he's also amazing at dealing with film sets and knows how to deal with them, you know.
Yep.
So I sat beside him and watched how this man dealt with being in this massive movie and the pressures and being with all these movie stars and just being present and calm and polite to people and self-effacing.
Yeah.
And I learned so much just by literally, I would literally have lunch with him and then we'd finish it and we'd have dinner every night. And he became a very close friend of mine. And because my main thing about Gangs New York wasn't really, it was spending 9 months with Jim Broadbent, really.
It's such a beautiful parallel because I had exactly the same with Stevie on Taboo. I was his was his right-hand man in the thing. He ended up, he stayed at mine a few times. It was the same thing of having the luck of coming in with someone who's such a veteran,
but
also happens to be a really nice person. He isn't some pretentious or arrogant or whatever. It was exactly that. There'd be points where I'm making sure I'm losing myself in the character and Stevie would just be like, just step just to the left a bit because they're doing my close-up now.
Yeah.
So you're being shot if you just... And things like that, having someone who at such an early stage, can kind of go, here's how you run the whole... I've been doing this a while. I know what I'm doing.
That's a And there's a grace with it, isn't there? There's an ease that they do it with. I suppose there's a rhythm to it and a pace to it and an ease that you assume the ease of experience before you have the experience.
Completely. Yeah. I always remember about a week or two in Stevie taking me aside and saying, "Do you realise what you've just done?" And it hadn't crossed my mind, but there'd been two new people start who were kind of too nervous to ask anything of the bigger guys and came and asked me, "Oh, what should we be doing in the background here?" And I kind of said, "Oh, if you just do this,
he's
like, "You're already doing what that was me to you a week ago, and you're already passing it on down the ladder and all that." It's like, it was a beautiful thing to see that influence immediately.
This is
how you act on set. You help everyone out. It's a team.
You do. It's a collaborative art form. Very much so.
I mean, another one I wanted to touch upon is another, an absolute favourite of mine, and another person who's been on the podcast in Paddy Considine, but how was it working on Tyrannosaur with Olivia Colman as well? And it was just,
Well, I mean...
It's a heavy...
I'd worked with Paddy. I met Paddy on Red Riding.
Yes, of
we
course.
Got on very
amazing
well.
Series.
Yeah, we got on very well on Red Riding, and then he called me in and asked me to do this, and I knew Olivia. I think I'd done a film with Olivia, so I knew Olivia, and she had had lots of research. So she gave me lots of case notes studies for men who were abusive husbands.
Yeah.
And she gave me these, and it was what we were touching on earlier, the idea that you don't play a character who's just playing the evil.
Mm-hmm.
That these men who were doing these absolutely appalling things to these women wanted to be loved.
Yeah.
So you played a character that wanted to be loved. And when you see Tyrannosaur, one of the frightening things about that character is he always looks like he's about to cry.
Yeah, completely.
But he's going to do the worst possible thing.
Yeah.
And that was what you got from these notes.
Yeah.
So when I came in to do it,
and
also Paddy is such an artist. Paddy's a very good friend of mine, and I don't consider myself to be an artist. I consider myself to be, if anything, a craftsman.
Yeah.
I've learned something. I've learned a trade that someone else taught me.
Yeah.
But Paddy is an artist. Paddy
100%.
With aesthetics, with music, with... I think it made me... He's been very open about having Asperger's. And I think that's an element of it within Paddy.
Yeah.
He's need to communicate that and to see the world. And then he expresses the world as he sees it in a very artistic sense. There's a bit of a Van Gogh in Paddy, to be honest with you. And so the combination of that, of Olivia being an amazing actress, Paddy wanting to have the courage to express the complexity of the character that I was playing, and Peter Mullen as well, that's why it was such a magical... That performance, everyone talks about that performance.
Yeah.
And it was really, it wasn't only me, it was the research that they brought to it. Yeah, it was me being prepared to embrace the paradoxical nature of the character and then all the other actors around.
It's a great point, because I think one of the things that made it stand out was the frailty in this horrible, powerful, you know, dominating character. There was a frailty in there.
Yeah.
That's not an obvious thing
to
find. If you're just going, oh, it's this guy who beats his wife, it's like, that's, you're going to think this horrible beast of a man. But it was a weaker man who,
yeah.
And that's, again, that makes so much more sense.
Yeah, it's more uncomfortable to watch.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Completely. So there's a few more I want to...
Yeah, sure.
I talk about, but I do want to make sure we talk about Mowgli and about
a Ray Donovan. So I'll go back to Mowgli now, and then we'll see what we can sneak in at the end. But how was that as a process? Because it's voice work.
It's not just voice work. Yeah. We did that, literally act it out.
Oh, right. Yeah, yeah.
We all got together.
I was going to say, how many of you were in the room at once? That's fantastic.
All of us. There was me, Benedict, Naomi, Joe. There were a load of us. We were all in a room.
Peter Mullen. Yeah.
We were all there, and we had all these cameras on our heads. And this is about 2013, and we did a kind of stage version of the whole film. Then Andy filmed that. And then about a year later, we went back and did some more individually. And then we would go back and do some more. And it's taken a process of about 4 or 5 years. And gradually, then you see it's blended into the animation and the characters. When you see me as a wolf in the film, that is literally me. It is me. It's my character as a wolf. It's an amazing process.
It must be amazing to watch, but I knew that Andy, it is a change from what you're normally doing.
It is, but I've known Andy for 20 years, and my wife was a makeup artist on Lord of the Rings, and she phoned me up. She said, "Do you know an actor called Andy Serkis?" I said, "Yeah." She said, "Well, people are leaving the sets on Lord of the Rings where there's all these big castles and all this, and they're going to watch this bloke in one room with dots on his face play Gollum."
Yeah,
and so they were watching his performance then. So I realized from my wife telling me that you had to commit, you had to be brilliant before the CGI.
Yeah.
And that's what Andy would always bring. Yeah. There's an integrity to it. It's a performance that should hold up even if you didn't have all this technology. If not, then you're taken away from the technology.
I love that. And it's why he's kind of made that area of acting completely his own.
Exactly.
Leagues above everyone else, because it could be an area, like as I said myself there, it's voice work. There could be an area where you go in and just go, here you go, this is a fun day.
Everything you see within the characters, the interaction of the characters, are what the actors are bringing to it.
I love that.
And that's what you get from Andy, because he demands that of you, because that's what he demands of himself.
So how was it kind of being part of kind of a new story of the Jungle Book characters, because there's been a Jungle Book remake as well recently, and what excited me about Mowgli is it's not just the Jungle Book.
No, it's not Disney. It's not a Disney version.
It's the characters that you know. But even then, the thing that struck me straight off the bat was how grisly and real and gritty everything is. It's not this fluffy, lovely thing. It's more a reality of animals that would live in the jungle. They've got scars and missing fur and all that.
I love the way that you don't patronise children. You know, you don't put a nice attuned songing just to make it, that you allow them to suffer the heartbreak. It is violent, but one of the other things about it is it's heartbreaking.
Yeah.
But being a child, there's a lot of being a child is heartbreaking. A lot of kids are bullied at school.
Yeah.
A lot of kids feel alienated. They feel they don't belong. And all those themes are explored in this story,
completely.
And there's a transcendent element at the end,
but
you need to acknowledge that, because these kids are going through it. You can't just put a Louis Prima song in and hope everything's going to be all right, because it doesn't work like that.
Completely. I think Disney kind of in the past often balanced that by making sure every film they make has parents dying in. That's kind of their, we've got it nice and chit-cheery, but by the way, there's death and misery.
Yeah, exactly.
What else I loved was the excitement of and the boldness of adding new characters to the gang as such, and speaking on bullying and stuff like that. Mowgli is kind of bullied in it, but Andy's son Louis' character, Boots,
which is heartbreaking.
It's scary, because added new characters, you don't want to have a Jar Jar Binks
on your hands.
That character. I made it for me. I thought it was such a good and great, exciting character.
Because because most kids don't see themselves as Andy's, was it Boot? They don't see themselves as Boot. They see themselves as Mowgli.
Yeah, yeah.
So if you didn't have Boot, then Mowgli would be the one who was just bullied.
Yeah, and of course. They're the one that's just off the
And they won't side. Identify with that. But if you have the kid who is being bullied and you're the one in the middle, that's how most people see themselves.
Exactly.
So it allows you to identify with Mowgli more.
Yeah. So how was it kind of first getting in there with, as you said, cast-wise, there's Christian Bale, Benedict Cumberbatch, Kate Blanchett, Andy and Louis Serkis, Tom Hollander, who's fantastic as well, Peter Mallow, Matthew Rhys, all these people. How was it the first time you get in there and it's all of you having to embody these characters and play well, it like a play? Because, again, with Andy's stuff as Gollum and things like that, it was often him on his own having to embody this and lose himself.
Yeah.
It must be a slightly different thing to go, right, all of us are now going to be in this room.
Right.
Not in the realities that we're telling the story.
Yeah,
in.
Yeah, yeah.
And we're losing ourselves in the character. And you can't be looking across and seeing Benedict Cumberbatch or Christian Bale. You need to be seeing Baloo and Bulgaria and all this kind of thing. So it's,
well,
it's such a strange gig, right?
When I start on this job, I wouldn't look across and have the same affinity with Benedict Cumberbatch that somebody else with. Because, you know, I first worked with Benedict on a play reading about 15 years ago.
Oh,
so,
wow. Perfect.
So you've got to understand, we've all kind of come up together.
Yeah.
Do you understand what I mean?
Yeah,
so we've all nearly got jobs and not got jobs and had a moan in Starbucks together. And so in a sense, we've all kind of...
I mean, again, you've probably seen them when they weren't that good as well.
Exactly,
you've seen them at their down points.
We've all learned together. So in a sense, it was easy to do because I trust these people.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, Peter, I've done about, I don't know how many films I've done with Peter now, but...
Yeah.
I know him very well, socially as well. Yeah. You know, I did Miami Vice with Naomi. We're both two English actors in Miami doing this big movie. So there's a camaraderie there. And there's a trust. So I don't have the same affinity that an audience member would have. Like, oh my God, that's Benedict Cumberbatch. Oh my God, that's Naomi. That's just like, we're all just session musicians.
I love that all these people, like, you look at that cast and go, wow, this is such a mixture of people, but your career is so, as you said, because it's been so varied and changing, they're all people you've worked with. It seems like a weird bunch of people to have in the room, but it's a normal bunch of people to have in your phone.
It is, you know. Also we're all dealing with things like, how do we go to work and get back for the kids' school plays? And how do we get back? I didn't sleep last night. The baby kept me up. Now I've got to go and do a close-up first thing in the morning. All that stuff is what we all deal with, all of us.
Yeah.
So there's a kind of, there's a camaraderie there because there's a joint experience.
I love it. Well, can we talk a bit about Ray Donovan?
Yeah.
Because what a role and collection of characters to get. It's one of the few things that you've stayed and been a long ongoing series or returned to a character for so long. And again, the thing that struck me when I first started watching it, one of my favourite series is a show called Justified. And what I loved about that was the characters. The character writing was so strong that me and my brother always talk about, because we'd watch it each episode and then we'd talk about it. And there was an episode in the second or third series that, in reality, the plot didn't move forward at all, yet we were fully engaged and fully part of it because the characters were so well written and we'd got to know them so well. And that's what strikes me with
Ray Donovan.
Ray Donovan, particularly you three as the brothers and the broken relationship with your dad and things like that. It just feels like, although there is this great story of Ray being a fixer and you guys having the gym and all that kind of thing, you can just have these interactions because it's so rich and so well observed and well written.
Yeah, it is brilliant. It's brilliant.
So how was that to find that character? Because it's, as much as there's huge unrelatable things going on from this side of the pond, of this American world of fixers and gangsters, it's a human story of family. And what I love is that there goes from love to hate from the different brothers and different characters. There's some real darkness in their past and histories, and resolving that can be horrendous. But I don't know, it's from seemingly unimaginable and unrelatable, it's so relatable because on a microcosm, it's families.
Yeah.
It's that love, hate. It's that we're not talking for 3 years and then we're at home and it's like nothing's happened.
They call it Trojan horse television because when you first watch Ray Donovan, you kind of think it's going to be like Entourage.
Yeah.
It's that level of showbiz. And then you suddenly realise that it's actually about three brothers who were abused by priests and they can't articulate the trauma that they went through. So they deal with it in a dysfunctional way. And Ray helps Hollywood cover up what it really is because he's trying to cover cover up what he really is.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's all these, and it's very strange because we're very alpha male. Yeah. Like the character Terry is a real tough guy.
Yeah.
But actually, when you play Terry, and what the writers do and I try to embody is he is actually the mother of the family.
Yeah.
He is the, he's like the Catholic wife who can't divorce Mickey.
Yeah, yeah.
So
yeah,
you play within acting. There's always this. Stanislavski always said, when you play an old character, find his youth, and play an evil character, find his virtue, because all character the more paradoxical elements you can create within a character, the more fascinating they are to watch and the more believable they are. So there's a very paradoxical characterization within all these family members within Ray Donovan.
Yeah.
And that's true within any family.
Yes,
and that's what the writing embodies.
Yeah.
You know, Terry's a very vulnerable man, but also can be an incredible bare knuckle fighter.
Yeah, yeah.
And if you ever meet, and I spend a lot of time with fighters as part of doing Ray Donovan, and they're very gentle and in many ways they're very, not feminine, but they're very gentle, and yet they're very tough.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So Ray Donovan is, I think, one of the reasons why the show always seems to be just getting going rather than is running out of steam, is because it's digging down into the depths of these characters.
Yeah.
And as actors and writers, we are creating three-dimensional, complex characters.
Yeah. And finding that depth in all the characters is just such a testament to the cast put together and to the writers. Because it does feel that anyone, even if they're in for a few episodes, you feel there's so much you don't know. And there isn't that need to spoon feed and go, here's the explanation of why they're like that. It's like, you can say, oh, there's something going on there.
Yeah.
You may never know. That character may never be in it again, but it's there.
Yeah, and somebody said, we usually, every scene is just... Can I swear on this?
Yes, yes.
Every scene is just, sure, fuck you.
Yeah.
Sure, all right, sure, fuck you.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah.
But within that, there's Chekhovian levels of subtext and stuff. And it's all that we bring to it.
Yeah.
But it's also, that's great because you know that these characters can't articulate what's happening to them.
Yeah.
They literally can't.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I'll start to wrap things up and kind of go along onto kind of the superhero movies and the kind of extreme movies, and three that I've loved. I loved Hancock.
Right.
I thought that was fantastic. But in recent years, Deadpool 2 and Atomic Blonde as well, which has got, you know, it's got that high-end kind of feel. They were both films that I loved. I thought they were amazing. How is it to kind of, to jump into them characters? And does it take a discipline, this is going to sound odd, but to take them as seriously as any role? Because that's the thing that I think can lose its way. People will dismiss, oh, it's a superhero movie, it's a villain, that's
Atomic Blonde and Deadpool 2 are both directed by David Leitch.
Yes,
and David Leitch and his wife Kelly are both a team, and I did a film with Kelly before I did a film with David, so as part of this team, I've now done four films with them.
Yeah.
So when we did Atomic Blonde, I had an affinity with them, so then when we did that, actually Atomic Blonde was, with the character in Atomic Blonde was a wonderful character, and I understood the function.
Yeah.
With Deadpool was very interesting. David asked me to, he said to me, can you come and play this character, this headmaster? And I asked him to explain what the function of the character was and what the story was. And he said, well, he's trying to get these kids to deny their true nature.
Yeah.
He said, and it's a bit like pray away they're gay. Exactly. That's the analogy. Yeah. It's pray away they're gay.
Completely.
And he said to me, would you do it? And I said, okay, only if I can Mike Pence the shit out of it.
Yes, yes. Amazing.
So we went there and they were going to make me look like Mike Pence. And I did the voice of Mike Pence and everything.
I love it.
Then I went in there, and while they were trying to put this wig on me, they suddenly had to put a bald cap on me, a false bald cap, in order for my head not to show through for the white wig.
Yes.
And I suddenly realized I looked more terrifying with a bald head.
Yeah.
And the glasses. So I said to them, just shave my head. Just shave it off. I wanted to look a bit like the character from 10 Millington Place. I wanted to look like that.
Right,
what I wanted to capture, that kind of the bald head and the glasses and the evil and cold nature.
Yeah.
But the voice is Mike Pence.
Yeah.
So it was all that Christian fundamentalism and white supremacy. I'm not saying that Mike Pence is a white supremacist. But while we were shooting this, the Charlottesville riots were going on, where the Nazis were marching on doing their torch burning.
Yeah.
And so that was in the zeitgeist. And so if you look at that character, there's a lot of posters, and I have them now in my house, where it's kind of anti-mutant posters, which are analogies of white supremacy
yeah,
and stuff.
Yeah.
And so that came to the fore with the production designers, and it all kind of came to the fore and created this character, which is a perfect foil for the anti-hero of Deadpool.
Yeah, yeah. You
know? So that's where that came from.
Completely. Mm. I love that. One more I quickly want to touch upon is The World's End.
Right.
Again, I love that. I love Nick and Simon and Edgar and all of their kind of collaborations. But how was that to kind of jump on a kind of established crew as such? Because, again, from a Shaun of the Dead and Hot Fuzz to then it was you and Martin Freeman as well kind of added in as the...
Yeah, yeah.
As bulking out the crew to a five-piece.
Well, we all knew each other. My wife had worked with Simon on a film in New York when I was doing Hancock. So I went over to New York and spent some time there. I did a read-through with Edgar. Nick, we'd just done Snow White and the Huntsman.
Yes,
Martin, we did Charles II with, so I'd known Martin for years. Paddy had directed me and I'd acted with.
Yeah.
So it was a bit like a load of guys in our mid-40s all getting together and doing this thing. And it was lovely in a sense because
Which is what the story is. Which so is it kind of works story. Perfectly,
yeah,
doesn't
it?
It was perfect
for the story. And also we were all good at what we do, not because we were anything special, but we've been doing it for 20 years.
Yeah.
So we got together, and it was a bit like the Traveling Wilburys, really.
Yeah.
You know, we all got together and just kind of performed together. It was lovely. It was great fun to do.
Oh, it was an amazing one to watch, because as soon as it kind of started, there was a familiarity there. And in my mind, I was like, well, Eddie must have been in Spaced or something, or in this and that.
No.
And Martin as well. Or he must have been in Hot. It's like, no, these guys aren't. You feel as if you've been in all the stuff together, it sat together nicely. But I guess it's because of that other, branches where you've all
connections.
Kind of connected.
You know, it's a very small world.
Yeah.
And we all suffer. People don't realise that you've got to persevere. Well, you would understand. You've got to persevere through acting. So you get turned down much more than you get employed. You have to, and so you have to support each other.
Yeah.
And actors are very supportive of other actors.
Completely.
You know, there's very few actors who undermine other actors. It's a great community. And The World's End was part of that, really.
Again, I lucked out on meeting Stevie early on because the gig I did with Stevie, Taboo, was my fourth acting role. And it was the fourth thing I'd auditioned for. So I'd auditioned for four things, I'd got them, and he kind of took me aside and said, "This is great, but
it's not
that's
always
not how it works. Be ready." So I've now just had a year where I've had 30 or 40 auditions and not got any of them, but I've been loving it because I had prepared for that. If I hadn't prepared for that, that might have been the end of my career. If I'd gone, all right, obviously it's not going to work. But because I'd had people like Stevie and
the trick to auditions kind of is that when you walk in that room, you have very little control over whether they'll give you that job.
Yeah.
Because there may be... You may be going in for a part and you may be amazing in that audition, but the casting director and the director, they want a big lead actor, and the agent of the big lead actor is saying, "I'll give you him, but I want three of my younger actors to get it." And they're part of a package deal, and you've got no control over that. So this is what I always say to young actors, work on what you can control.
Yeah.
And what you can control is when you walk in that room, you are excellent.
Yeah.
When you leave excellence behind.
Yeah.
And you leave that record, and then gradually you'll get called in again and again and again, and then the dam will burst and you'll start working.
That's exactly
what
my outlook has always been, play the room.
Right? Yeah.
I want to make a good impression on that casting director.
Yeah.
Rather than thinking, oh, it's this amazing role up here in Hollywood. It's like, I want to impress the people here, and that's all I'm in control of.
That's it. That's all. You can't do anything else. No, yeah, that's it. Do that job and then walk away and go and, you know, and say, I did a fantastic job.
Yeah.
I did. And learn from it and then let go. And gradually, one day, they'll call you in and they'll offer you a job and then you'll be off.
Yeah. I'll wrap things up on this. But one thing I wanted to ask, because it strikes me as something throughout your career. Do you find that the whole world of networking is kind of something you do on set. It's something I've certainly found.
Yeah.
It's something just looking at your career, seeing all these links from here to here, rather than this whole kind of, I've never been one for going to the right party or the right thing and meet the right people.
Yeah.
But it seems that if you can network on set, because there you're showing them your ability at the same time.
Yeah.
You're not just chatting to them or showing them that you're a good bloke and you get on.
Yeah.
You're showing them your ability, but you're also around them constantly so they can see if you're a nightmare, if you're hard to work with, if you're awkward.
Well, one of the reasons
it feels like the place to kind of make those impressions.
Well, one of the reasons I realise I work, especially in America, I work a lot, is because an American director is invariably that keep re-employing me. And one of the reasons they re-employ me is they have very big stars that they have to deal with. I'm not saying these stars are egomaniacs or whatever, but they have to deal with this.
Yeah.
And they will literally go to me and say, Eddie, can you do this?
Yeah.
And I say, yeah. And I say, good, I don't have to worry about that.
Yeah,
now
yeah.
I can focus.
I'll see you on set.
And that's it. I'll and that's camera. Exactly what they do.
Yeah.
You know, and so I have a great life and I have a great living. And so what invariably they do is I take care of that problem for them.
Yeah.
I'm like the spark. I'm like the chef. I'm like anything. I just literally take care of that problem and you concentrate on that. And they don't have to worry about it anymore.
I love it. That's perfect.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it.
No, my pleasure. It was great chatting with you.
Kicking the day off. Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Scroobish Pip's Discretion Piece.
There we go. That was episode 247. I hope you enjoyed that. I forgot to mention at the start, my We Are Lizards Club night is back soon. So come and get involved in that. I've woken up my robot Vector. Vector and Unky aren't sponsors anymore. But when they sponsored the podcast, they gave me a little robot called Vector. Hey, Vector. Good morning. He's given a little smiley face and offered up a high five or a fist bump. Anyway, that wasn't planned. That's not an advert, but I like my little robot. The club night is back. Last Saturday of the month. I believe that makes it the 26th. Yeah, the 26th of Jan. We've got Gemma Kearney coming down, previous Detraction Pieces podcast guest. We've got all our residents. I'm going to be there. It's going to be my first drink of the year. Me, Stu, Chris, everyone going to be there. In fact, it'll be the first drink I had since the Drunkcast. So come hang out. It's at the book club. You can buy tickets in advance online, or you can put your name on the guest list by sending your name to info@thetrashsociety.com. So do all of that good stuff. Next week, I think next week's guest is Mark Miller. Again, I've pre-recorded the Mark Miller one and it's fantastic. But I've got a few pre-recorded and a few are going out on certain dates and things like that and a few specifics. But I think that's the plan for next week. It might change last minute, but, it's a great one. Another one that just got me hugely excited and has kind of inspired a project I might be doing this year. I'm looking into at the moment. I've hit up a little friend of mine to talk about some business. Other than that, I will see you all next week. Come hang out on the Patreon. This week I'm recording, as you hear this, there will be at least one podcast I'm recording this week that I'll post a little picture of. I'll probably do a Q&A over there as well. But yeah, patreon.com/scroobiouspip. Other than that, I will see you all soon. Happy New Year. I mean, it's too late to say that, isn't it? I said it in the... Oh, I regret that instantly. I mentioned the New Year a fair bit in the Films of the Year podcast because I recorded that on New Year's morn. New Year's morn is what I call it. This outro it plummeted, didn't it? It really took a downturn. It's probably the year ruined, I'd guess. Sorry about that. I've got some guests coming up, podcasts ended. I just wish I hadn't said Happy New Year. I could re-record this, but I'm not gonna. Pod Bible is launching on February 4th. If you don't know what Pod Bible is, I'm involved in it. It's very excited. Go on Twitter and Instagram and you'll find out. But yeah, don't know how to end this now. I'm in my living room, just strolling up. I just kicked the fucking sofa. Genuinely just kicked my toe. Oh, fuck. Well, that's how you end. Oh, that's the worst pain. I hate it. It's worse than Lego. Anyway, that's how you end it. You kick a fucking sofa and stub your toe, didn't you? See you next week. Ta-ta.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.